You're listening to a podcast from Meaning of Life TV.
Hey, Dan. How you doing? How you doing?
Yeah, good. Good. Thanks for inviting me on.
Well, let me tell you where you are on. You may not even know where you're on. Let me introduce us. I'm Josh Summers. This is Meaning of Life TV, and you are Dr. Dan Keown. And as a doctor, you're a practicing physician, an emergency room doc, and also a licensed acupuncturist. And you've recently published a new book, which I'm going to hold up, called The Unchartered Body. Subtitle is A New Textbook of Medicine, which we'll be discussing today. So I became familiar with your work a couple of years ago when someone in my either acupuncture world or yoga world did a review of your book called Spark in the Machine, which seemed like it was a real attempt to show that Chinese medicine and Western medicine are not sort of divergent, non-overlapping systems of thought, that they actually are describing, A, the same thing, just with different kinds of language and different tools of understanding, but that they actually had things to inform one another about how health and the human body works. And this new book seems to be a more detailed continuation of that. So one of the things I want to hope that we can talk about here is, your particularly unique role as a Western physician as well as a trained Chinese acupuncturist in terms of facilitating a conversation between these two different worlds. And in doing that, maybe help people that are particularly skeptical think differently about what qi is, or the energy of Chinese medicine, what the meridians or channels are in Chinese medicine, how acupuncture might work, and then how that all fits into, you know, how we might think about what's going on in placebo research with acupuncture, and things like that. So to set the stage, and I know I've been talking a little bit, but to set the stage, I thought it'd be good to read a passage from a book by Sam Harris. And Sam Harris, to many of the listeners, is either someone who's loathed or celebrated. And in this passage from his new book, recent book, Waking Up, he says this. He says, "As I wrote in my first book, The End of Faith, the disparity between Eastern and Western spirituality resembles that found between Eastern and Western medicine, with the arrow of embarrassment pointing in the opposite direction. Humanity did not understand the biology of cancer, develop antibiotics and vaccines, or sequence the human genome under an Eastern sun. Consequently, real medicine is almost entirely a product of Western science. Insofar as specific techniques of Eastern medicine actually work, they must conform, whether by design or by happenstance, to the principles of biology as we have come to know them in the West. This is not to say that Western medicine is complete. In a few decades, many of our current practices will seem barbaric. One need only ponder the list of side effects that accompany most medications to appreciate that these are terribly blunt instruments. Nevertheless, most of our knowledge about the human body and about the physical universe generally emerged in the West. The rest is instinct, folklore, bewilderment, and untimely death." Now, I think, based on what I've understood from your writing so far, there's a kernel in that paragraph that you might actually agree with, and then a large chunk of it that you're going to have something to say about.
Yeah, I think the only thing I agreed with was antibiotics. the rest I didn't. But I'll tell you why, in a very succinct way. I gave a talk recently to the physiotherapists up here in England, and I started the talk by just saying, "How do you know if your patient's alive or not?" And everyone looked at me a little bit shocked, you know, and I repeated the question to them. I said, "How do you know? How do you know if your patient's alive or not when you see them? You know, it's a question no one really ever asks, do they? Because it's like, well, it's obvious if someone's alive. I mean, it can be a little bit tenuous sometimes if they're really deeply unconscious, and maybe if they're very near death, it might not be entirely clear. But basically, the reason that you know that people are alive rather than dead is because of energy moving around their body.
So, no one said because you can see them breathing or you can take their pulse and feel their heart pulse?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can do those things. But the thing is, you don't even need to do those things generally, do you? To look at somebody, you could look at somebody, you know, 99% of all the people wandering around, yeah, even breathing is a form of energy movement. It's energy that's making you breathe. So my point was that it's the difference between life and death is energy, you know, and you can even measure that with an ECG. You can even, you know, you can see the moment the energy leaves the body with an ECG because you get a flat line. Bing, bing, bing. Mm. So this is the fundamental difference between life and death. And this is energy. And this is, in my opinion anyway, indisputable. I mean, if you want to actually tell the difference between someone who's alive and dead, the most sensitive and the ultimate test really is an ECG. Because, say for instance, you had somebody who, you know, 99.999% of people you can tell, but just by looking at them, because you can see the energy moving. But say they were really on, you know, appear to be dead. What you'd do in emergency is you'd put stickers on their chest and measure their heart energy and see if there was any rhythm in their heart. Now, if there was a flat line, you know, everyone would look around and go, oh, they're dead. If there was some flicker of energy going on there, they go, oh, right, okay, you know, there's life. We might be able to do something here. So, I mean, in that thing that you read out by Sam Harris?
Yeah.
Was it? Yeah. Who I've vaguely heard of. There was no mention of energy there. There was talk of antibiotics, and which are great. There was talk about the biology of cancer. Well, cancer is just getting more and more prevalent. So whatever is known about the biology of cancer, we're not doing it right. And the human genome has manifestly failed to create any cures. Mm-hmm. We've unraveled the human genome and nothing has become of it. And I remember 20 years ago them saying, oh, there were going to be all these amazing cures. And it's fundamentally, I think, the fundamental weakness within Western medicine is that spirit, so chi translates best as spirit, not as energy, that spirit is completely lacking from Western medicine. Mm. So, and spirit is the difference between life and death. So you've got a medicine that ignores the fundamental difference between life and death, apart from in very small occasions like the ECG.
Right, right. And I want to try to explore some of the consequences of that negligence in terms of not taking into consideration that. Maybe before getting into that, though, a little bit about your background might be interesting to the audience. For instance, I was trying to think of how to frame this. Because you are a Western doc as well as a trained acupuncturist, the question might be which needle came first, hypodermic needle or the acupuncture needle?
Well, I always intended to, strangely, I went into Western medicine to kind of unravel the mysteries of Chinese medicine. And I went into medicine back in 1992, and back then acupuncture was kind of voodoo, and it wasn't even really practiced. I mean, if you went to see an acupuncturist, you may as well have just said, I'm off to see my witch doctor. You know, they were pretty similar in terms of their respectability. And I didn't really have the personal courage or conviction to go and become an acupuncturist. But also I wanted to learn what Western medicine understood and knew. And so I went into Western medicine and I kind of scraped through medical school. And then, because I always wanted to learn about acupuncture and Chinese medicine, and then I became an emergency doctor.
What was promoting, what was pushing that interest in Chinese medicine?
Oh, that was my grandmother. Yeah, Dora Gauss. She was an incredible woman. She went traveling around China in her 80s on her own. Now, I just thought everyone's grandmother went traveling around China, you know, and this is back in the 1980s, yeah? I thought, I remember my mum saying to me, like, that's kind of not, effectively she went, that's not normal. And I was like, oh, isn't it? You know, I was 14 or something. But yeah, so she loved all things Chinese. And one comment that she said to me stayed in my mind. She said that the West thinks that Chinese medicine is primitive because it's so old and unchanged. But she said the reason it's unchanged is because it was always right. So if you've got something right, you don't need to change it. No one suggests that the wheel is this ancient technology that is no longer relevant. The wheel is perfect, so we keep it. And so that's what she said about Chinese medicine and acupuncture. And so that's what kind of created the spark of interest. And my dad was a surgeon, so...
Oh, right. Okay, because that's your... You have a YouTube channel by a title that says, What God Forgot to Tell the Surgeon?
Yeah.
So What God Forgot to Tell Your Dad. This is really just working out your own childhood.
Well, yeah, it's interesting, the whole, like, that layers of, like, you know, what is going on in my subconscious to call it What God Forgot to Tell Surgeon. The reason I actually called it that is because every doctor I've ever said to has found that quite humorous. my publishers didn't. So the original title of The Spark in the Machine was What God Forgot to Tell Surgeons. And when I said that to the publishers, they just kind of, you know, there were, you know, you could just hear the wind blowing through the trees. There was nothing. And I said, no, but every doctor finds this funny. And they didn't really understand it. I mean, many people do understand what the joke, obviously, surgeons think they are God.
Right.
But the reason I've called it that is because the fundamental thing that you need to realize to understand acupuncture, really cheese, quite difficult in my opinion to get your head around, but the channel system is so easy to understand.
Well, that I want to pick up exactly on that, because I had a question that was around, if you're going to be talking about this Western model, I mean, not this Western, this Chinese medical model, to sort of a hard-nosed skeptic, do you feel like it's better to begin with a discussion of qi or like the energy system, or do you think it's better to discuss the channels first? And it sounds like you're saying the channels.
Yeah, well, I've had this conversation a lot with hard-nosed skeptics, doctors. And so, in my opinion, the easiest way to do it is to move quite quickly from qi, which is basically just spirit is the cleanest translation into English, but it's like a bioelectricity that organizes our bodies. And then that flows in channels within the body. And then this is why I never use the word meridians, because if you say to doctors or skeptics, the qi flows in channels within the body, which is intrinsically makes sense anyway, because everything flows in channels, given the opportunity. Then they'll say, well, show me these channels. And then you just open up any textbook of medicine or surgery or anatomy, and you know, all the channels are there. It's the negative space between things. And you can even, any surgeon, if you say to a surgeon, the fascial planes within the body, are they channels? They'll go, well, yeah, of course they are, because this is what surgeons use to navigate around the body. Okay. So this is the joke of What God Forgot to Tell Surgeons.
Right, surgeons
think that this navigation system was put there to enable to make their life easier.
Let's go back through some of what you just said, because there was a lot in there that may have fly over sort of the layman's head if they're not familiar with certain terms. People have heard of these meridians. It's pretty common language, but usually it gets dismissed, and it gets dismissed because people say when an anatomist goes in and tries to find these meridians, they don't find anything. And the people in the acupuncture world for a long time have been saying the reason they're not finding anything because the very biological substrate, the material that these meridians are located within, gets extracted in the course of the cadaver dissection.
Yeah, then that's nonsense too.
That's nonsense.
That's rubbish. It's so simple. It's unbelievably simple. Like, it's ridiculously simple. Like, And that's in the new book. I've tried to make it so simple as well. It's difficult to explain without someone who's actually seen surgery or done surgery. If you had a surgeon in the room now, they'd be nodding and going, oh, yeah, yeah, totally. Keyhole surgery. So keyhole surgery, that when they do keyhole surgery, what they're aiming for is this space, potential space within the body that just blows up. And then they're in this channel. They don't call them channels. They tend to call them cavities and things, like the peritoneal cavity. But it's a channel. And that channel is, in the case of the peritoneal cavity or channel, that's the liver channel. And so all throughout the body, there are these channels. And there's the reason why anatomists miss the channels when they were looking for channels is twofold. Firstly, because of the translation into meridians, which is a poor translation. The second thing is because they were using the channels to look for the channels. So it's like if you've got your glasses on your face, they were like the equivalent of, you know, where are my glasses?
Right.
That's what they would do.
So the channels are located within, I think what you would say is planes of intermuscular fascia, in a way?
That
begs the question, I did a conversation with David Lazondak about what fascia is, but people might need to just a quick overview of what fascia is and then how does it relate to the existence of these channels.
The channel system.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So fascia is... what is fascia? Good question, because it's actually a poorly defined word, fascia. And so when we start saying, what is fascia... The next So a better word to use to describe what we're talking about is actually the triple burner and the Xuing Lo system, which is the Chinese words that have been coined specifically for these systems. Yeah. However, given that fascia needs some explaining, I'll explain it. So fascia is generally understood as a macroscopic, in other words, you can see it with the naked eye, very thin silk-like material throughout the body. It's everywhere in the body, wrapping everything. So if I cut open my arm now, there would be fascia tying all the muscles together, wrapping all the muscles and wrapping around the bone. And in fact, the word fascia, which is the same as fascism, and it actually means ties together. So bind together. So in the House of Representatives, I think, in the US, they have the two rods either side of the speaker's chair, and it's sticks tied together, and that's the fasces. So that's what fascia is. It ties things together, but more importantly, it's like this silk, very thin silk structure, and you can see it on slow cooked meat. You can see it on chicken or anything. It's that silky type, very thin stuff that you kind of cut and then you're into the muscle straight away.
Right.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I know about fascia. It's
I just
want to make sure that we get a working definition
listeners.
For people. Yeah. I mean, I've heard it described as a three-dimensional bodysuit. It's kind of a three-dimensional body, a fabric within the body that binds and holds everything together, organizes things, transmits forces, all that.
This is the problem, you see. So fascia is poorly defined. In fact, I even managed to find an article from a proper journal that pretty much said exactly the same thing, that fascia is just poorly defined. And we can talk about what is in the body, and within the body there's definitely like a three-dimensional spider's web of mainly collagen. That effectively, if you were to blow, if you had some kind of ray gun that blew all the cells out of the body, like, you'd just be left with this skeleton. The skeleton's part of this system as well, actually. You'd be left with a skeleton, but also all of this, like, fascia that was supporting all the cells and holding them all in place.
Right.
You'd be translucent. You could see through that body, right. But it would be there.
But you'd have a veritable likeness of the body. And Tom, anatomist, body worker in the States, you probably heard of Tom Myers, describes fascia as the environment that your cells live in.
Yeah, exactly. And there we go back to the problem with the word fascia as a descriptive word, because it's If you speak to a surgeon, he certainly wouldn't call fascia that.
Right. There's not conformity in the world around fascia, what it actually is or signifies. Because it used to be just sheets of connective tissue, like the plantar fascia, the aponeurotic fascia.
Exactly.
And now it's having this more, a broader connotation throughout the body. But when you're talking, let's come back to the channel, like of acupuncture, channel system. You're talking about, and this is something that I had misunderstood my own understanding around the theory around where these channels are located, but I had thought that the channels were located within the fascia itself, like the fascia in between bigger structures, say the fascia in between bone and muscle, between tendon and muscle or something.
Yeah.
But you're saying, and this is what I think is quite interesting, is that you're saying the channel is the space between planes of fascia. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
And those...
That's it. And this dovetails, you can open up any anatomy. In fact, the very principle of surgical dissection and anatomical dissection is to use those channels between the fascia to navigate around the body. That's the principle.
And the main principle, just to be direct about it, is that in going about surgery that way, it reduces trauma, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's zero trauma.
Right.
Yeah, zero. You can do, that's why you do keyhole surgery. You know, because basically once you're through the skin into this fascial plane, which is the peritoneal, it's called the peritoneal cavity. It's actually a channel because fluid flows in a circuit within it. Once you're in there, you can just do whatever you like. You know, you can just wander around, have a look at the appendix, have a look at the ovaries, have a look at the fallopian tubes, go up, have a look at the liver. And then they can take bits out as well. But obviously then it causes trauma. But the actual, that's why they do this, just to have a look. It's called explorative laparotomy.
Have a look, sir.
Laparoscopy. Yeah, and they just have a look. Yeah, they're just, I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? You do an operation just to have a gander, a look inside. So the channels, the one of the key things actually that I try and get across is just how damn simple this is. The whole thing, even chi is relatively complex compared to the channel system, but the channel system is just unbelievably simple. When it first dawned on me what this was, which was in China years ago, it just blew my mind, because I was like, this is so simple.
Right, and I'm trying to think about how to bridge the connection between the channel system and kind of a model of understanding what chi is. One of the things that you've written about in both of your books is the relationship between embryological development and the development of these fascial planes within which the channels are located, right?
Yeah.
So is there a simple way you could talk through that? Because that to me, I don't even think many acupuncturists are aware of the simplicity of that kind of way of understanding it.
Yeah, so basically, interestingly, in The Sparkling Machine, I approach it from an embryological point of view. In this book, I take it from almost like an evolutionary point of view. In other words, a functional, why did our bodies develop in this way? When I started writing this book, I looked, I started thinking about the body and thinking, well, we all, you know, I personally believe in some form of evolution, you know, that we've all kind of developed our things. Some people don't, but,
I think you're in good standing. It's good standing to believe in evolution on this platform.
Yeah. I think it kind of makes sense to me. I don't see why people have a problem with it, really, because I don't think it means that God doesn't exist or anything. It just means that God likes, you know, having a bit of fun. Possibly, anyway, we won't go into that. But so when I started thinking about where did we come from, I kind of naturally ended up at jellyfish. And I think it was because of the way we reproduced. It looked very similar to the way in which jellyfish reproduced. And so I started building this book around the idea that if you can understand how a jellyfish works, yeah, then you can start to understand how higher animals also work. And it's all about planes. Yeah, a jellyfish basically has three planes. It has an inside, which is composed of effectively exactly the same cells as our inside, endoderm. Has an outside, which are composed of exactly the same cells as our outside, which is ectoderm. And then it has a middle bit, which is called a metaglia in jellyfish. And it's just like a jelly. In fact, it's fascia, basically. It's collagen and water. Mm-hmm. So it's basically like fascia in the middle.
Can I just pause for 1 second, because I did find that there was one of those moments when I was reading the book that it kind of had this sort of, oh, that's really, really interesting. Because when you talked about the jelly bit in a jellyfish being, you know, water and collagen and probably some other like ground substance type materials. And in the transition out of the ocean onto land, how the ratio of those representative materials changes. There's much less water and a lot more collagen. And I think the way you described it was that the collagen was required to resist the force of gravity.
Yeah, well, that actually, to resist it, you need bones more than anything. Then you get cross-linking of the collagen. So the collagen allows you to create much more propulsive power. Now, I'm not a evolutionary scientist, so I might not be completely correct on this, but as far as I understand, you know, collagen and cartilage, what that allows you to do then is attach muscles to these things, and then you can create more power. Mm-hmm. You know, a jelly, obviously, you can't push or pull against anything within a jelly. You know, all the jelly can do is that.
Yeah.
You know, and then when animals in the ocean, they don't need to resist gravity. And then when they go on to land, they need to resist gravity, so that collagen needs to become stiffer. And what happens then is the collagen is cross-linked with things called hydroxyapatite crystals, which are like, it makes bone, basically. It's bone, you make bone. But the jellyfish has these three layers, an inside and an outside in the middle, as do we, and our inside splits into four, effectively. You end up with four layers. But these layers are become the acupuncture channels. Now, the boundary between the cells, so in the jellyfish, you have a layer on the outside of ectoderm, and then you have a middle, and then you have an inner one. And those boundaries is where the kind of the channels would be.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if kind of jellyfish, because I don't know if jellyfish have acupuncture points. I mean, almost a good title of the
where are the jellyfish
in a way, isn't it? Do jellyfish have acupuncture points? I don't know if they do, but they have chi. They definitely have chi.
Well, you know, and maybe we're going to get a little ahead of ourselves, but one of the things I've liked about the way you describe the role of the function of an acupuncture point is that it helps navigate points of transition in the organism where the conductance of energy through the channel can become, you know, problematic, stagnant, blocked, congested, etc. And so, you know, those and in vertebrae in humans, those points are located at, oftentimes at joint cells.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, so a lot of the acupuncture points are, and the jellyfish, presumably, I mean, they don't really have joints, so.
But they have a lot. They have a lot less. I mean, this is a really interesting question. What do the acupuncture points actually do? Because, and one of the ways I ask that or answer that question is to say, well, what happens when you lose acupuncture points? So in other words, what happens if you lose your arms, or if they're not even grown in the first place with thalidomide? And the answer is that you don't, as far as we know, anyway.
Pause a second. I had to look that up when I was reading the book. Thalidomide, it was a sleeping medication given to women in the 60s that caused all sorts of birth defects. I wasn't aware of that until I read it today. But, so, missing limbs. basically.
Missing limbs, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So these people have, no, you know, sometimes born with no limbs, sometimes, you know, amputees will lose their limbs. And as far as we can tell, you know, their organ function doesn't deteriorate directly anyway. I'm sure losing limbs isn't particularly healthy for your organs. So then it's like, well, what are the acupuncture points actually doing in terms of affecting the organs? And the way I understand it is that the most important thing for, and this goes back to the embryology, the most important thing for the organism is to stay connected. When your body's growing it starts as a single cell and it divides and divides and divides and it divides, and it's got to stay connected. It's got to. Those cells, all of the cells in your body, yeah, even now, all my cells have to know what they're doing in relation to the body. Yeah, and what happens if they lose sight of what they're doing, and they can start reproducing on their own, multiplying on their own, and then you get cancer.
I was going to say, that sounds like cancer.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So they have to stay connected. Now, when the body's growing in the embryo, that growth is really strong, really powerful, and it's occurring at a fantastic rate. And so the thing that keeps them connected is qi, for want of a better word. It's not so much that it must be qi. It's more that there must be an energy that's doing this, and this energy can even be seen. The scientists now are starting to video electrical currents flowing in developing embryos, and that's what the qi is. It's keeping everything in the embryo connected. And so when it comes to the acupuncture points, the qi is just flowing out from the organs down the channels, just as a kind of function of the organism to keep everything connected. And it tends to flow down these pathways of least resistance, which is why, for instance, the heart channel just simply follows the arteries. Mm-hmm. Well, that's why the heart channel goes the way it does. It's just following the axillary artery, brachial artery, ulnar artery to the little finger.
But just to be clear, it's not in the artery itself. It's in parallel.
Good question. Yeah, but in my opinion, the arteries actually have three layers to them. I think it's just on the outside of the artery, the actual channel. I think I've actually seen somebody killed. Well, I didn't see directly killed, but I've seen some. They've seen the sparking machine.
I actually wanted to have you get into some of the anecdotes you've seen in the emergency room, because I think these are kind of interesting and chilling.
to a certain degree. I mean, people don't believe this one actually about like the person. I told it last place I was working, and everyone was just like a bit shocked and didn't believe it. But it's as you know, my grandmother's grave. It's true. And so this junior doctor came to me and said, you know, this patient's got lung cancer. So they were really sick anyway, lung cancer, and they've got a bit of fluid on their lungs. And said their SATs are 85%, which is pretty low, but he was probably like this for weeks, you know, months, and he was dying. And she said, oh, should I do a blood gas? And I said, well, there's no point really, because it's not going to change what we do, you know. He's already on oxygen, you know, it's not going to change anything, you know. Which is a good reason not to do a test. If the test won't change anything, there's no point doing the test. You effectively, a medical test, what you're really doing is asking a question. You're asking a question to the test, and the test should then give you an answer. She went and did it anyway, because she was petrified that she'd get in trouble from the admitting doctors, that they'd said, why didn't you do a blood gas, because his SATs were low. And then, like, so 5 minutes later, I hear this arrest call, and so I was the senior doctor on, so I go to the arrest, and I hadn't seen this guy, actually. I hadn't actually seen him. And but I saw the girl straight away, and she said the moment she put the needle in and got blood back out of the artery, because he was attached to an ECG, she said the moment she saw the blood coming out, the line on the ECG just went ding, complete flat line. Unbelievable. belief, but it gives me goosebumps thinking about it.
Yeah, no,
he was dead. There was nothing we could do. It's like, that's the worst rhythm, flatline.
And then, but the reason why that was so lethal in this case was because of the point, the acupuncture point that was proximal to that area that she drew the blood, right?
Well, the arteries are actually the heart channel. Again, you remember I said that everything is much simpler. It's so simple.
Yeah.
It's so simple, man. The heart, yeah? What channels leave the heart? Well, it's just one, the aorta. Well, you've got a pulmonary artery as well, but you've got the aorta coming out here. It's this big channel coming out. Again, the use of the word channel is just so much easier. And it splits. One goes up here, the carotid splits, goes into the brain, and goes into the face, and then merges in the eye. And this is the exact description given of the accessory heart channel within the classics of Chinese medicine. They don't call it the artery, which is a shame, because it would have clarified things. It's the artery. And then the main channel just follows the axillary artery, brachial artery, ulnar artery, down to the little finger. So when they put a needle into the artery to take blood, that was the heart channel, and they extracted a little bit of blood, but they also extracted a bit of qi.
Now, you know, I don't, this is a little bit of maybe acupuncture, fine tuning, or fine details. I thought in the story, it was in the book, it was on the lung meridian.
Yes, it is.
It was lung 9.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, good point. It is on the lung meridian. But again, so yeah, no, that's a very good point. So this is the thing. So even though it's on the lung channel, the artery, as I've just explained, the arteries are the heart channel.
Right.
So that's why even though any artery, especially above the chest, any artery is the heart channel.
Mm-hmm.
It's all simple. Right. Yeah. If it's an artery, it's physically connected to the heart. It's the heart channel.
Yeah.
Below the chest, it becomes the Chong Mai.
Right.
So it's a little bit more complex below the chest, because the qi dynamics change. So yes, you are absolutely right. It was on lung, because that's where you take blood. You take it from here, which is lung, around lung 9. And lung 9 is also called the master point of the blood vessels.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's why I thought it was quite interesting. But I don't want to lose the non-acupuncturists in the audience. Let me see if we can come back to now trying to maybe unpack the concept of qi. Because, and just to review a little bit, we have channels that are in the space between fascial planes. In your model, like six big channels, which often get divided into 12 or multiplied into 12, because there's six for the upper body, six for the lower body. What is between these channels on a biological level?
Yeah. Yeah, so the most, as I explained, the most important thing, which is accepted within embryological science, the most important thing is the body has to stay connected. And the big question that embryological science has been asking for over 100 years now, and has kind of got close but never really quite answered it, is how does this organization occur? Yeah, how does the embryo organize itself into a body? Because you start with one cell, you end up with 100 trillion. Now, I mean, I struggle to organize my family, and there's five of us. So, and a country of 50 million appears unorganizable, but a body is 100 trillion cells. So how does that stay organized? Now, what science has shown is that there are, about 70 years ago, this guy showed that there was particular areas that were called organizing centers that kind of oversaw the organization. And then they found there are these chemicals that moved in the body, in the spaces between cells, and that they controlled the organization. And now what's being found is that actually the thing that is organizing all of this is like an electrical force. So to really understand what qi is, you have to understand the profundity of the question, how does the embryo self-organize?
Yeah, where does self-organization come from?
Yeah. And unless you understand how deep and profound that question is, because that is the key question in embryology. Now, if it's the key question in embryology, that means it's the key question in the entirety of health.
Now, is there a kind of more reductionistic, conventional answer to that question? How does the body organize? How do the cells organize? No.
No.
Like genetics.
No.
Genetics.
Basically, it just keeps falling flat. They keep trying to find a kind of reductionist answer to it, and it keeps falling flat on its face because, I mean, you've got to kind of understand how effing amazing this process is. You know, our puny human minds compared to, I mean, think about it. It was, how old's the Earth? You know, so say it's 600 million years old or whatever, 6 billion. And evolution's been going for 600 million years. And it's basically, if you imagine the Earth as like a laboratory experiment, the size of the Earth with all these creatures, like, you know, as part of this experiment. Have you ever read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Not in a long time. But yes.
All right. Well, you know that there's a subplot in that about the Earth is actually a computer program.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
And the mice are in charge. Yeah. So you know, in a way, it's not a million miles away. So if you imagine that going on for 600 million years, and eventually after that, you get to a point where, like, you've got this cellular organism, in other words, us, that can reproduce and self-form and extract everything it wants from the environment, yeah? And it can do all of this from one cell that just divides, remembers exactly what it's supposed to do, and then just divides, and makes a new person, yeah? And so the idea that we can, like, our puny minds can just go, oh, yeah, it's all, you know, because of this or that. Sometimes things are actually just bigger than we can really understand, and that's where basically this force that's driving it, we can map it, we can see it, we can describe its how it moves the channels, and we can even see that it gets concentrated in areas what are called organizing centers in embryology. Mm-hmm. But then we just start to fall down in understanding it because it's just so, it's mystical. It's a mystical force.
You've used the word electricity a few times in conjunction with this force.
And this
is where I, like, you know, I kind of wonder, in your particular unique role as the Western scientist, Western doctor, and a Chinese medical practitioner, does that word get you in trouble in either camp to refer to this electrical current? And it's a very small amount of electrical current going through the channels, if I'm not...
Oh, yeah, yeah, tiny, yeah. Unbelievably tiny.
I mean, and...
Well, there was a guy called Becker who tried to measure it, like, and did really amazing research on salamanders and regeneration. You know, 50 years ago, he wrote a book. He's dead now, actually, R.O. Becker. The Body Electric. I think it's on my shelf, actually, somewhere. And so he was measuring these currents in salamanders, and they were just incredibly tiny currents, like, you know, kind of picovolts or whatever, just really tiny.
But in one of your YouTube videos, you have footage of embryology of a frog, right? Developing.
Yes.
And that's showing these flashes of electrical current moving through,
yes,
to help organize the face of the frog, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Now, the interesting thing is, the electricity, it is electricity that's doing this, but it's electricity with information attached.
And that's the thing.
That's the thing. Exactly. That's the thing. It's not just dumb electricity. It's not like, you know, otherwise you could just be like, which you can do, in cardioversion, but apart from in cardioversion, you can't just say to somebody, oh, your chi's a bit low, just stick your finger into the plug socket just give yourself a boost. You know, because it's got information attached to it. And in fact, in cardioversion,
what's cardioversion?
Oh, cardioversion is where you give shocks.
Yeah. Paddles.
Yeah, paddles. And so when you do that, you do synchronized shocking as well, which effectively is attaching. So you can just do dumb cardioversion when someone's dead, just give them a shock, yeah? You try and effectively try and restart the heart that way. But if they're almost dead and you just want to get their rhythm into a better rhythm, you synchronize it. So effectively, you're adding intelligence or information to that electricity when you do this. And so this is the key thing to understand about in a one-word answer. If you would say, what is chi in terms of the body? You would say bioelectricity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you had one word. But it's got information attached to it.
With information attached to it. And I guess, you know, what kind of information?
Well, the vital energy. Life energy. Yeah, that thing that kind of keeps you alive. And so this is when the Chinese... So this is how the Chinese medicine is incredibly sophisticated. People thought, you know, like my grandmother said, it was primitive. It's actually, like, I've got my foot in both camps. It's so sophisticated, Chinese medicine. It's streets ahead Western medicine. Western medicine's the primitive one.
Mm.
Yeah, Western medicine's basically, it's got no philosophy of health. It's got no philosophy. It's got no... There's only, like, one test in West... You know, it relies on all these tests. There's only one of them that can tell you whether a patient's alive or not, and that's the ECG. All of the other tests are useless. They can't actually tell you whether the patient's alive or dead. I mean, how... You think about it. I know it sounds kind of a bit flippant and not important, but it is. Whereas Chinese medicine is just much more, like, concerned about, like, how alive you are.
Yeah, I mean, I think you even say this in the book, that Western medicine is really good for acute things where there's a local issue that can, you know, can be kind of surgically directly attacked or rectified. But for more systemic things...
Or you're just about to die.
Yeah, systemic things, chronic things, psycho-emotional things, stress-related things, it doesn't work quite as well.
It's very good. Western medicine is very good. I mean, my specialty is emergency. And actually, if you look at all of the other... So my wife's an obstetrician. And actually, if you look at where obstetrics is really good, it's actually also basically effectively emergency obstetrics as well. So obstetrics, in this country anyway, we have a good system where we have midwives that handle normal. And then when things go wrong, the obstetrics... The surgeons, well, effectively the surgeons step in and try and fix things. And that's kind of emergency as well. So Western medicine's very good for emergencies. Now, why is that? Probably because they've got amazing tools.
Mm-hmm.
They've got amazing tools. And they do have you know, the thing is when you've, at one level, I suppose, your body is a machine at one level, you know. The heart does pump blood round, and if you can pump blood round with the machine, then it will kind of keep the body alive. So, I suppose maybe that's why it's so good at emergencies.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you your emergency doc, but do you also have a clinic where you work as an acupuncturist?
Yeah. Okay. So I do. Well, I haven't worked in emergency now for about a year, which upsets me because I do love emergency. It's great. But they won't let me in this country anyway. They won't let me. They won't let me be the best doctor I can be because I can't use acupuncture. And I know that when people come in, I can fix, you know, a substantial amount of their problems. I can fix with acupuncture. And I'm not allowed to use it. And you know, and you've got this epidemic of opioids.
Right.
And they're effectively saying to me, just give opioids.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to go back into it, but I haven't practiced for a year. So I just do acupuncture.
Got it. That begs the question, and I get this question, I forget to mention at the beginning, I'm also a licensed acupuncturist in Boston.
Well, I figured, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so in a way, I'm the choir asking me preach to, but this is good. You know, I get asked this question a lot. And I'm curious how you answer it, which is, what is acupuncture good to treat? Like, what conditions is acupuncture good for? And
my answer would be, I know it's not a very good marketing answer, in my opinion, pretty much everything. I think it should be first line for everything. I say that as a Western doc as well. Like, I mean, okay, in extremis, yeah, when somebody comes in and, you know, septic, for instance, yeah, well, yeah, fine, you know, not first line for sepsis, but that's the really extreme. You know, it's becoming more common. But.
Well, there's been a little bit of blowback about people who pursue alternative therapies, or and we should probably use the word complementary therapies, but complementary therapies for chronic things like cancer, for example. And the blowback is around people who just take the alternative complementary therapy die faster than the people that take the more conventional route. So you wouldn't be advocating that, though. Like, if someone came in with cancer, would you still say
take the Western? Depending upon the cancer. I mean, cancer is like an unbelievably broad disease. You know, it's unbelievably broad. You've got cancers that, I mean, I've got a whole section in the book about cancer, and, you know, you've got blood cancers, which are completely different to solid cancers. And then you've got many things that are diagnosed as cancer. You'll outlive them. You know, so bladder cancer is one example. I used to do urology, and there were all these people who were having their bladder cancers monitored, and, you know, one of the consultants just said, oh, most of these people just die with bladder cancer or prostate cancer. I mean, prostate cancer, when you get to about 85, if you microscopically examine every man's prostate, you'll find they've all got a bit of prostate cancer somewhere. Cancer is much more common than you realize.
Right, but for the sake of argument, for the virulent cancer that could knock years.
So Western medicine is terrible with cancer. Anyway, it's awful. It's terrible. I mean, unless the only thing I would say is, so cutting things out works if you catch it early enough. Definitely, cutting things out works. That's great. So surgery, I would be. If there's a surgeon who says, look, I think I can help you, I'd be like, yeah, go for it. Chemotherapy is just awful. I'd like to see more studies on chemotherapy. As far as I know, the studies out there show only, so you've got to treat 50 people to get one of them to survive one extra person to survive over 5 years. So you've got to, and it's incredibly poisonous. And also, those effects, in the studies that are 20, 30 years old, apparently disappear in the real world. So in other words, chemotherapy effectively poisons your blood, like Chinese blood. Yeah, it just kills the blood. And that's why the cancers also require that blood to get nourished. So this is Chinese blood, which is the same as Western blood, but more complete in its description there. So the cancers require blood to get nourished, and so they suffer as well. But as soon as the chemotherapy goes away again, the cancers come back again. You know, and this is what has been shown. This is why chemotherapy doesn't work very well. But more importantly, the chemotherapy is so poisonous that your chance of mortality in the real world, in other words, when you're not in a trial where everyone's like really, really watching out for you, is 10% in the first month on chemotherapy. In the UK it is anyway. 10%. So these are people who've got cancer, who've been told by their oncologist that we think chemotherapy can help you, who aren't expected to die, certainly not in the next month. Yeah, they're not expected to die soon, otherwise they wouldn't start chemotherapy. And 10% of them are dead within a month from the chemotherapy. So basically, when you put acupuncture up against this, it's almost like, blimey, even if it's doing nothing at all, it's probably better, you know? In all seriousness, I've said this for years, I would love to see a study, I'm being serious as well, where you basically presented people with the facts, and said, like, this is what we know, these are our studies on chemotherapy in your cancer, You can either have the chemotherapy, or it's going to cost us like 60 grand to do the chemotherapy, or you can have the 60 grand. Go and live your life with 60 grand more. And I reckon, because so much of the stress with cancer is like the financial stress is enormous. I reckon if you did that, I have a feeling that the people you gave the money to in 5 years' time, more of them would be alive than the people you gave chemo to. I'd love to see that study. I think it's an ethical study to do. If you up front with people and say, look, this is what we're measuring, and this is what we know. So does that answer your question?
I'm not sure. Well, I mean, I was going to say, if I ever get cancer, I'll volunteer for that study gladly. You know, it does sort of raise the other topic I wanted to bring up with you, which is around placebo research, and particularly this kind of this argument that if acupuncture works, it works only by virtue of being a placebo, a really good placebo.
And oh, no way. No way. I've seen, firstly, I've seen, you know, like nosebleeds, like crazy nosebleeds stopping in emergency. You know, people have done, you know, acupressure to an emergency, weren't even aware I was doing acupressure, and their asthma just gets better, stuff like that. So, I mean, short answer, like, no way.
Yeah.
Long answer is that placebo is much more complex than, placebo is actually one of the most important things in the therapeutic encounter, full stop. In fact, the word placebo is a misnomer. Kapchuk, he talks about therapeutic encounter, doesn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
And just for listeners, there was an article in the New York Times maybe 2-3 weeks back about maybe the placebo is actually far more potent than we've given it credit to be. And Ted Kapchuk was referenced as a big section on Ted Kapchuk in that article. Just 2 cents on him. He wrote one of the early Western books on Chinese medicine called The Web That Has No Weaver. He was a practicing acupuncturist for quite a while, and then he got into, I think, pain management, and then he segued into doing placebo research at Harvard.
Yeah.
That sound about right? But
yeah.
He oversaw a study on irritable bowel syndrome, right? With acupuncture. And this is what like some of my medical friends will use to throw acupuncture under the bus. They'll say, in this study, one arm of the trial, they were given kind of garden variety acupuncture treatment, but rather than having the needles actually inserted, I think a machine was inserting the needles, but not actually inserting them. It was like pretending to insert them. Or something like that. And then another group was given sham acupuncture, meaning not using real points. And that second group was given a lot more personal attention by the practitioner.
Yeah.
And then there was a group, then there was an arm, the control that got nothing. And they found that both the non-insertive real acupuncture, whatever the hell that is, and the sham acupuncture group both had better outcomes, but the group that had the better, practitioner care, the one that, where the practitioner really spent more time and listened to them, that group turned out to have the best outcome of the three.
Yeah,
and then so then it's just saying, oh well, acupuncture is just placebo. And to me, this is where your understanding of what the acupuncture is working within, I think, is a strong argument against that. And I'd like to hear maybe you speak to that.
Well, Kapchuk's research is great. I love his placebo research. I mean, my favorite one on the IBS. I think he likes IBS because. I think it's particularly, I mean, IBS, you know, from a Chinese point of view, yeah? IBS is bowel, so bowel is thinking, overthinking, so.
Yeah, he lives in Cambridge, not far from me, so everyone overthinks and is worried.
Exactly.
Harvard, so, MIT people.
So if you could just get them to almost, like, stop worrying, yeah? I mean, IBS in Chinese medicine is worry, yeah?
Yeah.
So if you get them to stop worrying, then they might get better. So I think it's particularly sensitive to having that placebo effect. But one of the most interesting studies he did was when he had IBS patients, and he said that the ethics approval for this was a nightmare. Yeah. And he only managed to get, and he said he said, I'm going to give you a placebo. And they'd be like, well, what's a placebo? A placebo is an inert pill that doesn't have anything active ingredients. It's just a sugar pill. I want you to take this 4 times a day. Yeah. And they're like, okay, so it has nothing in it of value. No, nothing. It's just a sugar pill. Just take it 4 times a day. So he had a control group. 4 weeks later, because he only got ethics approval for 4 weeks, because for some reason this is unethical, the IBS group were doing, the placebo group were doing so much better. So much better. And these people were told that this was a pill that was a placebo, and they were still doing better. So, I mean, that just gives you massive pause for thought. I mean, I thought about this a lot, and my thinking is that the ritual of taking a pill, like, changes your behavior in such a way that it can create a healing response. So everyone knows this. When you go see the doctor, yeah, you've had a problem. Eventually you make an appointment. You go and see the doctor and you get there and you feel better. I don't know. Maybe you haven't had that.
No, I definitely had that. Right? And I see it with my dog too.
Yeah. Exactly. So the whole thing is, I think there's a ritual associated with that, which is actually on one level is just an acceptance you've got a problem. Yeah? I've got a problem. I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to go and see the doctor. So just that acceptance, you know, is, I mean, what they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, they go, the first step is to admit you've got a problem. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a large part of placebos is just, or therapeutic encounter, is just that the moment people, like, actually accept that they've got a problem and they need somebody else to talk to. And then there's other things as well. So there's the emotional things that are going on. I think when you talk to somebody about your problems, it probably unburdens you emotionally. So there's all kinds of things like that going on with placebo. Now, that applies to all of medicine, everything. Yeah, surgery, the whole lot. And in fact, all good doctors try and maximize placebo as much as possible. It's called bedside manner. Mm-hmm. So,
well, but, yeah, all good doctors, right?
The good doctors. Yeah, and in fact, actually, what you really want to do, if you think about it logically, let's say that as captured conclusion that he's come to, is that placebo effect is probably arguably the most powerful effect within medicine, yeah? Apart from antibiotics, like I said at the beginning of this, antibiotics, yeah. Apart from that, it's probably the most powerful thing within medicine. So arguably, your best medicine is going to be doing as much nothing as possible, which is what good doctors know. So good doctors know that Voltaire said it, the art of medicine is amusing the patient until nature takes its course. And then also there's a book called The House of God, where one of the rules of the House of God is do as much nothing as possible. So basically, like, good doctors already know that you do as much nothing as possible. And acupuncture is basically, I don't think it's nothing at all, but it's as close to nothing as possible. I think it's very powerful medicine, acupuncture, but it's as close to nothing as you can get. So, and if the art of medicine is doing as much nothing as possible, then acupuncture is the sublime example of the art of medicine, which is my opinion.
I mean, as an acupuncturist, I'm biased to appreciate that way of articulating it. Maybe, and I had a question in this list somewhere where I wanted to ask about, what do you think is happening when an acupuncture needle is inserted and manipulated, and then I want to kind of bridge that with why placebo research on acupuncture, I think, is rife with difficulty. Because, you know, the idea of doing sham acupuncture, like needling a part of the body off a channel, at least from the way you describe the way the body is interconnected through various connecting channels and main channels, you know, you can't isolate and not influence something lateral to, or, you know, adjacent to something, just because it's not on the exact channel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and also, so there's different levels of what the needle does. So I do think that the needle, just inserting the needle, also creates a kind of placebo effect, therapeutic encounter, in the same way that those guys who were taking a pill four times a day for their IBS got better. I think just randomly putting a needle anywhere in the body probably has a therapeutic encounter effect. Plus, so a level above that, I think that probably there's also some kind of mild healing effect just from sticking, or some kind of balancing effect just from randomly sticking a needle anywhere in the body. Yeah. Hmm. So this seems to be what the studies show, actually. But then above that, so when we start to get into the real art and science of acupuncture and what's going on, what happens in health is that the chi just flows around the body very smoothly, you know, in the same way that the embryo grows. In our bodies, chi is moving around smoothly. And then it can get stuck. Generally, all pain is stuck chi. And then what you're trying to do with the needle, for instance, in pain, is you're trying to just get that chi moving again. I mean, this is a big question. What are you doing with the needle when you stick it in?
You're probably familiar with Dr. Helene Langevin's work.
Yes, yeah.
And she's shown years ago that when a needle goes in and is manipulated, that the collagen in the fascia at that site of insertion winds around the needle and creates a kind of a micro stretch. Which propagates further along
and that
the channel.
That would be if you could see the electrical currents going on there as well. That collagen, I bet you that collagen would all be kind of tangled up with electricity, you know, because collagen's piezoelectric. So
that's a word that, I mean, this is where I was trying to get you to connect the dots on, because if you are inserting a needle and creating a piezoelectric, what does piezoelectric mean?
It means that whenever you bend a material, it creates electricity. But equally, the opposite is true, that you can use electricity to deform a material.
Yeah.
So the most obvious example is in a cigarette lighter. You go click, 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 you get a little spark.
Mm-hmm. So,
and they use it, I think, in airbags as well.
Right, and I think that they're using children's sneakers that have the light bulb light up. Yep, there's a little crystal there. So basically, the collagen is responsive to the needle, and by manipulating the needle, you think there's a kind of deformation or a change in the formation of the collagen in a way.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's, yeah.
That would create a little bit of information, of like bioelectric information, variance in that tissue.
Yeah, see, now this is where we get to the edge of what we know.
Right.
In my opinion, anyway, as far as I know, we just get to the edge of what we kind of scientifically know. So we have to move into like
speculative bullshit territory
that have been laid down for thousands of years, and just slightly take it on their word that they knew what they were talking about. But I agree. I think it probably does do something to the collagen. And I think if you could see the energy, because if you could see the electricity, because it's very difficult to actually see the electricity, obviously, that's there. I mean, even on my skin now, there'd be electrical currents. You can't see it, you know. So in fact, the surface of your skin is slightly electronegative compared to the interior, and that's probably the Wei Qi, and it repels viruses and bacteria and things. But I get when it actually gets to the point of what does that needle doing when you reach and contact the Qi, I just go with the ancient Chinese at that point. But I think you can.
And what's their answer?
Well, their answer is like water. They just say it's all like water, isn't it? And I think that's a great, because actually, if you look at the flow of electricity, you could also describe that in terms of it being like water. So electricity has voltage, which is basically like the height, the potential difference. In fact, that's what it's called, isn't it? Potential difference voltage. So the potential difference it can drop, and it has a current. It's even called a current with electricity, and it has power. Creates power as it moves, so it's very similar to water. So I just see chi as electrical water within the body, and then it's like I find more interesting actually what it's doing in the organs, what chi's doing in the organs, which you'll get to in section 3. That's when it gets interesting, because in the spark in the machine, what I really was describing was Yuan Qi. And one of the feedbacks or questions I used to get was, but what's it actually, when you stick a needle in, what's it doing in the organs? And I kind of went, I don't really know. But when you start getting into the structure of the organs, you realize that they all run on electricity.
Interested medical folks can definitely be advised to check that out. I know we're kind of running towards our time a little bit, and given that we're coming out of the holiday season into a new year, oftentimes people are sort of geared up with aspirations for better health. Do you have a few tips that you often give your patients that kind of across the board that are things that they could do to optimize their qi, help circulate their channels better? What do you recommend? Whether it's dietary, exercise, kinds of things?
Yeah, I always recommend people to grow their own food as much as possible. Work less, if possible. Simplify their lives. Sleep more in the winter. Party more in the summer.
Sounds pretty good.
That's kind of... Growing your own food is a big one at the moment, because I think most of the food that you can buy or you buy in the supermarkets is now such poor nutritional value and it's so difficult to actually find good food that realistically you should start to grow it. Like, not self-sufficiency levels, but even if you just start growing herbs.
Mm-hmm.
And carrots are quite easy.
are there things that people consume regularly that you think are just verboten, like that just they, if you could take one thing out of someone's mouth, what would it be?
Oh, what, food wise?
Yeah.
No, because I probably eat them.
fair enough.
What do you think?
There's the classic one in acupuncture that, you know, things that insult the spleen, which is the digestive organ of Chinese medicine.
Yeah.
But things that insult the spleen are sweet, dairy, cold. The trifecta of that is ice cream.
Yeah.
And if you add, you know, baked Alaska in that mix, you get fried food, which also creates this pathological phlegm in the system, which just...
You're just describing American cuisine, basically, aren't you? I will say one thing, actually. One thing that people should take out of their diet is modern wheat.
Hmm.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's poisonous. I think for two reasons. Like, firstly, I think it's borderline indigestible because of the way that they've just created really high yields. So the Green Revolution, they just tripled the yield. Something had to give. But more importantly, I think it's the glyphosate and the arsenic and other stuff that gets sprayed on. So I always recommend that to people. Get rid of the wheat out of your diet. And
do you think that's do you think that's connected to the rise in gluten intolerance?
Yeah. I think a lot. Well, the endoderm lining of your gut is lined by this endoderm, which is also in the jellyfish. It's very, very delicate. And so it's, I mean, the other thing that's starting to go through the roof is gastrointestinal cancers.
Mm.
Like, these things were like, you know, when I was at medical school 20 years ago, like, colon cancer was an old person disease. Now it's becoming a young person.
Really?
Yeah. It's like, and they're scratching their head and going, why is this? And it's like, I wonder if it's anything to do with those poisons that you're spraying on all the food that we're eating. Those poisons that are also carcinogens, you know. Yeah. And so, I mean, to me, it's food. The food is the big... I think, like, growing your own food, or just starting with herbs, just that's the gateway food drug. Once you start growing herbs, then you know you can move on to to harder food.
At one point, I did want to like whip out the line, like to ask you what kind of kale you've been smoking, but it's become clear.
Yeah.
Listen, Dan, it's been a pleasure, real pleasure to talk to you. I've really enjoyed both your books. So, and I would say, you know, someone wasn't an acupuncturist or a medical practitioner, would you recommend they go to the Spark and the Machine first?
So Spark and the Machine, I'd say, is for like if you like popular science. I got really upset with my publishers because I thought it was mismarketed, Spark and the Machine.
How was it marketed? How did it get marketed?
Just like the cover. I really didn't like the cover. In fact, I wanted this picture on the cover. But almost wrote that book because of the cover. Almost. The Spark of the Machine is definitely a book for people who have a scientific bent, I think. I mean, don't you?
Yes. No, I think there's a fair degree. And I didn't feel like I fully had the scientific literacy to march through it. Unscathed.
And also, like I've been saying to them that they should split that book into three as well. That the first, What God Forgot to Tell Surgeons, they should separate that and sell it as a separate book, because it starts to get really deep in part two and part three.
Yeah.
The Spark and the Machine, it gets into like embryology and it gets quite complex, and like it loses a lot of people, and it's not supposed to lose people. It's just that you want to understand why the spleen, why the spleen governs transformation and transportation
in Chinese medicine.
That's it. But most people don't want to understand that.
Right.
So the Uncharted Body is basically for if you want to understand how your body works, and you want to, it's almost like a self-help manual. It's like my ambition is for the Uncharted Body that it becomes that book that like. When you were growing up, you used to have like kind of before the internet, people had like, I don't know, anatomy or medical books or something like that hanging around the house, you know, people of a certain middle class persuasion. My ambition is that this becomes that book that people just have hanging around the house.
Yeah. And I have to say, the videos that you're doing on YouTube, sort of, they're small 7-10 minute little talks that you're giving with the visuals that go along with the book really help. I think would help the reader move through the material in a more digestible way. So that's a great addition.
Yeah, good. Yeah, because I was wondering about that because I hadn't got a huge amount of views, but I just thought I'd.
It's early days. No. You consistency is the key. Consistency. Yes. Keep putting those out.
Yeah. I agree completely. Yeah, because I kind of like thought, well, what. All the YouTube people I like, I mean, they just keep churning them out. They're not necessarily like amazingly high production values, but it's just that, like you say,
the content, the valuable content.
It's when people know that they can go there and there'll be new material, they start going there to get the new material, isn't it?
Yeah. Keep get the archive built. Listen, I know it's getting late there, so I want to let you go, but I really want to thank you for your time, and we'll include links to everything we've discussed in the show notes below.
Yeah, pleasure.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Meaning of Life TV. Meaning of Life will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Meaning of Life programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.